Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
My next guest is Daryl Stinson. Daryl's story of becoming a Division I athlete and then suffering a career-ending back injury, one of both hope and bravery. In today's episode, he's going to share his mental health struggle. And this episode does have a trigger warning, as we'll be talking around suicide, mental health and depression. That doesn't mean that we can't learn from Daryl's journey, especially with what he does now so courageously to help others find their purpose. Welcome, Daryl, to the Bravery Academy. I'm really excited about having you here. And as I mentioned just before we started, it's because this topic that you're going to share today is very close to my heart. It's actually been one of the reasons why I do what I do for my purpose. And we're going to talk about purpose a lot in this episode. Before we start, though, can you tell me about where you're from and where do you live now?
I'm originally from Michigan in a small town called Jackson, which nobody knows where that's at, but it's about an hour from Detroit. And Tony Dungy, who's a very famous NFL football coach, is also from there. So I grew up playing in Tony Dungy Stadium, a little fun fact about me. And currently I reside back and forth from Franklin, Tennessee to Metro Atlanta in Georgia.
Amazing. Amazing. So tell me about your career or your experience playing sport, because I think that's kind of where things started in many ways, right? So growing up in that small town, what was it like?
Well, man, I mean, it's like the typical inner city street life type of thing that was going on in our communities. And for me, the only way I knew that I was going to get out of that dangerous environment was to either be a rapper or to be an athlete. And so I actually decided I was going to do both, did a little rapping and also to really go for it athletically. And if you've heard anything about my story, you probably know I didn't really fit in growing up and always felt like I was too white. I spoke too articulate to fit in with Black community. And then I wasn't like street enough, tough enough to really fit in with the Black community. So it was just like, I was too white for the Black community and I was too Black for the white community in a lot of ways. And so I grew up in that racial divide. And part of what solved that for me is I became really good at sports. And I noticed that it really didn't matter if I talked intellectual or if I talked street, if I listened to rap or I listened to country music. All that mattered is that I was getting recognized nationally for my athletic ability. And so, yes, I essentially became a top 100 athlete in the U.S. and earned full ride scholarship to play really football and basketball at Central Michigan University.
Well, you played two sports. I thought it was just football. That's huge.
Well, so I went to play two. And when I got there, they thought they were not going to use me my first year of football. And since football paid for my scholarship and they found out like this guy is better than we thought, they actually didn't allow me to play basketball because they didn't want me to get hurt.
Interesting.
I know. Still mad about that.
Well, it's those dividing moments in life, right? Sliding doors where you could have had that experience. So your life was really on track and it was very much around your identity being an athlete. And that was really your ticket out, your survival mechanism to find a new way. It sounds like you're kind of in that survival mode a lot during your childhood and coming through.
Yes. Yes.
And so what happened as you went through that career then?
So I ended up getting injured at the end of my true freshman year, which was devastating for me because I was supposed to play in at the next level. And I questioned why I was here. You know, like I knew people liked me for my gifts. I didn't think anybody liked me for me. And in a lot of ways, because I wasn't showing them me. One of the things I tell people all the time is it's really hard to be fully loved if you're not fully known. And so I wasn't letting the world know me. And I was hiding behind this facade of an athlete and of a jock and of a tough guy. And so when I got injured, that got threatened and I couldn't let it go. Sports just wasn't what I did. It was who I was. So I actually begged them to let me come back to the team and sign a liability waiver. And then I came back and I played for 2 years and I just put my body through all this pain of still pounding that injury over and over again, even though, you know, it wasn't fully healed yet. And I managed to start for 2 years. Because I say me hurt was better than the next person fully healthy. But ultimately that just crashed and burned. I couldn't stand up straight. My performance dropped and, you know, I was having a lot of suppressed emotions. And so that like my mental health wasn't stable. Like I started to have some of those suicidal ideations and things like that. And so ultimately they kicked me off the team because I wasn't useful anymore. And then that's when I was forced to face the fact that, hey, I don't know who I am. Everybody believes I'm this false version of myself. I can't hide behind this mask any longer. And ultimately, that's what, you know, sent me down, you know, this road of like, I don't want to be on this planet anymore.
I think it's really important to speak to that. Had you had depression symptoms before that at all?
I did. I wasn't really as consciously aware of them. But when I look back, like that moment of being teased for talking too white and like this conflict of feeling like people are only hanging out with me because I'm an elite athlete. Like I had moments where I was like, man, people wouldn't even care if I was around. Right. But I didn't know to call them suicidal ideations at the time. They were just thoughts, which is what a suicidal ideation is. But yes, I had lots of that growing up. It was just more intense once I removed that outlet of sports in my life.
Yeah, I think that's really important as well, because it's that kind of combat sport as well really is an outlet for stress. You're in your fight mode, right? You're in fight mode the whole time. So then when you're dealing with all those thoughts, so it sounds like the thoughts growing up were still really quite strong and negative, which is really normal too. But I think your story is going to hope for others to see is that so many of us feel the way that you have felt and we just don't talk about it. So I'm in New Zealand, obviously. We have a really high mental health rate. So one of the worst rates for suicide in youth. I think it's actually one of the top in one of the most developed countries, which is just disgusting. And while we try and do things, I still don't think we're dealing with a lot of the root cause behind it, even around emotions and around that mental health. What did you learn?
Emotions weren't safe. Emotions were not allowed. A couple of stories that I tell is number one, my mom primarily raised me as a single parent. My dad was around once I turned 5 or 6, he started to kind of come around joint custody. But for the most part, my mom was like my primary caretaker. And she was both like mother figure and father figure to me. And she was really concerned about me being too soft. And so she didn't want me to be soft. And so when I would cry or try to talk back or something, she would often be like, hey, stop crying. And then if I would cry a little bit more, she would like raise her hand at me and said, if you cry again, like I'll give you something to cry about, like threatening to hit me. And what it did is it like forced me to like suppress these emotions. And there were times where if I couldn't control the cry, she would literally smack me or send me to my room. And so it started to create this belief like, hey, my emotions aren't safe. You layer that on top of the fact that I live in a violent community. And if they sniffed or saw or smelled weakness in you, like you were going to get jumped, you were going to get bullied, you were going to get picked on. And so the number of times I ran from people who just tried to like jump me or beat me up because I was a tall person, and they couldn't fight me one-on-one. They had to like gang jump me. It taught me, hey, when I'm walking up the street, I can't even show the emotion of being friendly because that's going to be a weakness to them. Okay. You layer that on top of the fact that like my father wasn't an emotional person at all. His dad never really even talked to him like that. And so my dad was a much better father than what he had. And I'm grateful for that. I always say he was like physically present, but he was like emotionally absent. And so the model that I had of a male in my life was like, hey, men don't communicate emotions. Okay. And you throw that on top of the layer of being an athlete and we're taught not to show weakness. And here you have a whole ball of suppression. Okay. And so emotions were something that wasn't safe. It was something that got you picked on, something that got you bullied, and something that lost you respect.
And particularly in your foundation of your life, which is your figures of like your mother and father. So I really think it's important to kind of, for people that may be listening at home, to be, there might be some aha moments with that because they go, oh, I had a similar thing. It's like be seen, not heard. Okay. Yep. So that does flow into worthiness and love and self-love. And so it's really then hard to know where are you even safe? Like where are you safe in your life if you're not safe at home to show your full self and then how that evolves through. And I think that's the beauty of this as a man now. I know you've got 4 children. Is that right?
Yes.
So breaking that
3 girls and a boy.
3 boys and 3 girls and a boy. That's good. That's going to be a busy household.
Yeah. I know.
If we're going to be safely held, of course you had to hold it in. So it must have felt like a little volcano just brewing and brewing for you.
Yeah. In retrospect, it was. While I was in it, it felt undetectable to me.
Yeah.
Because when you get so used to suppression, it becomes your norm, even if it's not normal.
Yeah. Well,
that's a good point.
I think that's the other bit of it, the differences I've learned as well around suppression and repression. So you get to a point where you know you're not even doing it, just that repression. And so it that's when your body keeps a score and it's because of that survival mode. And I like just for people to see that there is a point where you can circuit break it. You don't have to stay in that space. And so that's where I work a lot from my physio background was always from the body. And I could see people coming in with this emotional and psychological pain and turmoil. And I was like, well, your body's keeping the score. Let's start with that. And that became the way in. But that can feel really woo to people as well to kind of be like to shift it. Or people might try yoga or mindfulness and meditation. They're like, I didn't fix it. I'm like, no, it probably won't because your body's in survival mode. It doesn't even know how to get out of it. It doesn't even know how to get out of that freeze. So no wonder you felt that way in your childhood is probably what I'd say. It's a lot and it's really common. And the more that we can talk about it and join the dots, we can start going, okay, how do we talk about these emotions differently? And I think that I've seen that in the last even 5 years in New Zealand, we're using it a lot more in schooling. So kids are getting all the more information around how to express emotions, what emotions mean. And it's still kind of like bad, sad, glad, mad, but it's still a vocabulary that they're able to kind of at least articulate, which definitely was not given in that or given that space to express it. And to figure out, it's like that response, right? That stress response, it has to finish. So your emotional response also has to finish for us to be like, I've let it out safely.
Yes. Yes. So good. You mentioned something that's so important in terms of being able to communicate, even if it's just sad, mad, like sometimes that emotional vocabulary is helpful because when you've been suppressed and repressed, you don't even have the words to describe how you feel. And that was what it was for me. The only emotions that I was allowed to exude within my community. When I say allowed, it wasn't like I obviously had personal power that I could have tapped into, but it wasn't like the culture. And I was allowed to be angry and I could be frustrated, like rage was, that was okay. Right. And so even growing up as an adult, when I got married, you know, still learning how to work through that, all I knew how to do was get mad. So every argument, what's wrong? I'm mad. It's irritating. I'm upset. Da-da-da. And it's just like, really? And so I started going to counseling and doing work. And
the emotional aware was one of my work things I always bring into my work because it's a game changer.
Game changer. Game changer. I mean, I would say changed my life for real.
Yep.
Because I know. And so my counselor was just like, well, what else did you feel? And I'm like, I don't know. I was mad. What else did you feel? Well, I was angry. What else did you feel? Well, I was frustrated.
Yeah.
And I had no emotional vocabulary. Well, I look at this emotion wheel and I'm like, I think I felt hurt.
Yeah.
Hurt. Yeah. And my ego had to die because to say I'm hurt as a macho, tough guy was so humbling, but it was so helpful. because how my wife responded to somebody who was angry was totally different than somebody who was hurt.
She's going to run away, man. That's her survival mechanism as woman. It goes back to our evolutionary biology. We're like, well, we're not safe. He's angry. He could hurt me. And that's even though that's not the truth, it's like the way that our body is wired as women. It's really fascinating to then go, okay, so how do you shift yourself? How do you become self-aware, which is what you've been doing? How do you self-regulate? And then I think the bit that's been really coming through the next chapter of your life sounds like the self-compassion. Is that right?
Self-compassion. I think there's still some acceptance, some healing. And when I say healing, I don't necessarily mean in terms of like the wound that's there. I mean healing in terms of like, it's that part of healing where it's like, hey, you can take off the cast, but you still have to learn how to walk.
Yeah.
Like beautiful. That feels like where I'm at. It's like this cast is off, like the wounds emotionally, the trauma is healed, but I'm still learning how to walk and be vulnerable in this world at the level that I'm doing as an influencer.
Yep.
And so that's where I feel like I'm at 100%.
Take me back then to what happened after the career ending injury.
Yeah. So I just spiraled, man, just let that darkness eat me alive. And ultimately I ended up in the psychiatric unit in Detroit, Michigan for multiple attempts. And it was in there that my life changed. I found faith. I tell people that I did my first journal entry, saw my first counselor. I did my first mindfulness exercise. And I started to learn that I could access the same feelings of acceptance, of love, of connection, of respect within myself that previously I was getting from sports. And so the way that I say is I learned, man, hey, I can build my life from the inside out and not the outside in. And that was a paradigm shifter for me. And I left that place. And that's exactly what I went on a journey to do.
So can we go back to your coaches that you had and the culture in the sport at that university level? Were they looking at any of this sort of stuff around your well-being as an athlete?
Not really. I mean, people can't see what they're not aware of, right? Like you can only see that which you are. Like we don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. And so if I'm not an expressive person, if I'm not a vulnerable person, I'm not going to see an area where somebody else is not being that way because it's just normal to walk around suppressed. So you're talking about a bunch of athletes and a bunch of guys. Everybody was suppressed. Everybody. We're all just angry. We're all just taking it out on each other, beating each other up in sport. And nobody's really talking about feelings or emotions or anything like that. So the staff, the faculty, my teammates were completely unaware. They thought I was fine. In fact, in a lot of ways, they probably thought I was doing better than them because I knew how to put on the mask. I knew how to smile when I was around people. But when I went home and I was alone by myself and alone with my thoughts, that's when that emotion would well up and I would cry and I would like be in a rage or I would find a way to suppress somehow. So that's what that was like for me.
So that's really good around the emotions and how it's coming through. Did you notice in your body what was happening?
I was completely unaware. Now I can describe to you what was happening in my body now because I've done somatic work and I've been able to get all the tools and stuff. But then I had no clue. It was just all disconnection. Not listening, suppression, spiraling the emotion. Like there was no like, what am I feeling? Or like I had no awareness. Now in retrospect, it was everywhere. It was in my gut. It was in my back. It was in my heart. It was in my legs. Like it was everywhere. But I wasn't at all sensitive to or aware of what was going on then.
Also, that can be quite painful when you actually stop and feel it. Because the emotional pain and physical pain is still expressed in the same part of the brain. So when you're in the emotional state of pain and you're sensing that and then the body's hijacking, especially that gut and heart, those parts are so powerful. And I think that's the big piece when we talk around mental health and suicide and being aware of like that. It's because of the way that we're trying to deal with the survival mechanism. And when we're looking at that, one of the things that's come through a bit more recently is really understanding this relief of tension. Because when we get into that instinct mode, we're trying to take that pressure off in any way.
Yeah.
And that relief of tension can come from so many things that we do in society. Well, sporting, exercise was your relief of tension for a long time.
It was.
It was a really healthy one in many ways. And people can do that now. But then we can over-exercise and we can keep doing that. And we're still not allowing ourselves to slow down or breathe. And so we keep ourselves in that state. And then we have the other ways in our society around alcohol, big culture in our country in New Zealand, and drugs. There's an element of that coming through as well. There's so many other ways, sex addiction, pornography, so many things that we are doing, trying to relieve tension and not dealing with the way that we actually feel.
Yeah, because it hurts. And that part about the brain is a really big piece. But, you know, I think deep down inside, there's that everybody has that desire to be connected, to be seen, to be heard, to be loved. And one of the things that I think is important to mention is just the importance of vulnerability within this process, right? I tell people all the time, like, when I was going through that, I used to put out little hints on social media, and I wanted somebody to respond to these hints and be like, hey, are you okay? So I would say something like, for every dark night, there's a brighter day.
Yeah.
Tough times make tough people. And I would want somebody to be like, hey, are you all right? Like, do you need anything? And nobody would. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it just made me feel worse because I felt, see, nobody cares about me. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, I wasn't actually being vulnerable enough to let people know what I was actually going through. And I always tell people that vulnerability is like a Batman signal for love. It lets love know that it needs to rush in. How somebody would respond to for every dark night, there's a brighter day is totally different than if I would have been like, hey, I feel like people only love me for my athleticism. They don't love me for me. And I'm thinking about not being here anymore. I guarantee you I would have had people that would have reached out and offered to help and made sure I was okay. I would have got the love that I was desperately longing for on the inside. I just was too afraid and didn't know how to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So I always encourage people, if you're perpetuating that narrative around like nobody really cares, or if they did, I would self-assess and be like, am I being vulnerable? And that's not just true in a mental health crisis. That's true as a leader. You know how many leaders and executives and high achievers are walking around carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders,
yep,
all because they won't open up and be like, I need help. I'm not Superman in all areas. I'm not Superwoman in all areas. Man, it's a powerful thing when we can actually tap into vulnerability.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
So how did it shift then after Detroit and going, right, I actually am worthy and I have got something bigger for me to do here? How did they get you to here?
Man, I would describe it like following nectar. I was just searching for what felt right, what felt aligned, what brought me life. And some of it was finding myself again, because remember, I had adopted this street persona, this athlete persona, and masked this affectionate, loving person that I was on the inside. And so I had to like figure out, what music do I actually like? What do I actually like to wear? How do I actually like to show up in the world? And so there was a lot of personality assessments, a lot of like spiritual retreats, and a lot of journaling, yeah, a lot of meditation, a lot of just like asking myself what felt like tough questions. And then there was some exploration, right? Like trying out some things, trying out speaking, trying out writing articles for people, trying out working in this environment, just to see what I was really passionate about, what was really sticking for me. And ultimately, the theme was all around communication. I had this gift to tell stories. I was won some awards working for a higher education institution. And then people started to ask like, hey, what happened to that elite athlete guy? And they started to get out there and they asked me to come speak. And I was like, nope, I'm a marketing consultant now, you know, like not doing that, not trying to like talk about that eighth area of my life. But ultimately, once I evolved to the point where I did that TEDx talk, that was it for me. Like, because it put a lot of the stories that I was afraid to share publicly out there on the world's largest stage. And then people started requesting me to speak on those topics. And so I had to show up and talk about them over and over again. And I was so insecure about my speaking ability because I was so suppressed. And so I had this like wall of like, if I'm really myself, I'm going to encounter that same rejection that I experienced when I was a young kid. And so there was a lot of hesitation, a lot of half-stepping in that. But I had to keep showing up because there was a level of resonance that was taking place in the lives of other people. And they were like, man, there's this tall, black athlete guy that's being vulnerable on stage and talking about real raw issues. This is so helpful, so life-giving to us that it put a demand on me to continue to be that way, even though I didn't want to be that way.
You got stuck with that personality.
I got stuck with that. I got that. And it was a gift to me. I needed it. It's actually how I came up with, it's not something new, but it's how I came to the revelation of the term story healing, right? And that people could heal from a process of telling and expressing their story because that was my experience, right? I started to notice that the more I told these stories of pain and defeat and betrayal and of depression and of repression and of suicidal ideations, the more I realized, wait a second, I'm not that guy anymore. And it awakened me. And I'm like, whoa. And it was so healing to be like, man, you have a sound mind. You're giving life to other people when you didn't even have life to give to yourself. And it was just such a powerful thing for me.
Do other athletes that you've worked with feel the same way? Like, would they have like their career, that vision has like just stopped?
Man, it was like 2014. I remember like one of the times where I shared some of like my story about transitioning out of sports and the kind of like spiral down that I went through online on Facebook. And I'll never forget a former All-American track athlete, she was a female, called me and she said, she was bawling, she was crying. She was like, you're not going to believe this. I've been saying something's wrong with me and I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I heard you live and I heard you express your challenges with transitioning from athletics. And that is what I've been facing. That's exactly what I was going through. And she said, I was watching your live stream while I was at work and I was crying. And one of my coworkers came over to me and asked me, hey, are you okay? And she said, I started to explain to her, like this guy that I'm watching. She said, my coworker started crying because her and her husband have been arguing because her husband has been going through it and trying to explain this thing to her. And she doesn't understand it. She's like, why are you crying? You got your school paid for. You got to travel the US and play on the world's largest stages and national television. Like, what is there to whine about? Like, get over it. It's sports. And she just didn't understand the identity piece and the emotional attachment and the place that it was feeding on the inside of me. And she heard her husband through hearing my story. And it was such a powerful moment for me because I was like, man, this is the impact when I open up. This is the impact when I choose to be vulnerable. 100% of the time, somebody is going to thank me for that because they are in that same situation in some way themselves.
I know you can't rewrite the stories and this is the journey that you've been on, but what things would have made a difference to you?
Oh my, we don't even have the time to get into that. There's so many things I would do differently. Regret was one of the things I struggled with because I was such a smart kid. I was in accelerated learning classes as a kid. So I had this trajectory of like, I could have been student government president, and I could have been academic and I could have went to an Ivy League school and et cetera, but I just had to be the athlete, had to be the jock and had to be the street persona. And so I struggled with regret for a long time. So I would have done everything different. Specifically, I would have definitely got more in touch with my purpose and myself and my passion. Everything was about what makes other people happy and it wasn't about what brings me happiness.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's a good thing to say, hey, I know you're saving the world. I know you're doing all this stuff for other people. I know you're like taking care of employees. I know you're like leading, but like, are you really doing the things that bring you life? Are you really doing the things that like that you're passionate about? And if not, start to get explore those things and start to add those into your life. And I promise you, it's going to start pulling you in that direction because it's life giving versus life draining. And we like things that bring us life. And so I would have definitely, you know, did way more personality assessments, way more time in nature, way more self-reflection, way more journaling, way more dating myself.
Yeah.
I'd also been way more vulnerable. And I know we kind of talked about like being vulnerable from the perspective of like talking about the pains and the challenges one experiences. But in my experience, there is a spectrum of vulnerability that isn't just you voicing your pain. It's also you standing in your power, right? It's just as vulnerable to be like, hey, I'm struggling with this thing and I'm going through this issue, as it is to be like, hey, I'm taking a stand for this belief in this particular area. And so I would have had vulnerability on both of those spectrum. So, hey, here's some of the struggles I'm going through. And also here's some of the truths that I believe. Man, I don't think that we should be gossiping. I don't think we should be pumping drugs throughout our community. I don't think that this is how we should lead our culture. I don't think that this racial divide and calling Black people who are intellectual whites is something that we should do. I'm going to stand in that power. And that's vulnerability, just like it is to talk about my pain and my traumas that I've been through. And that's a really important piece, because every time I bring up, especially around high achievers, oh, the power of vulnerability, the first thing they think of is the one end of the spectrum. Oh no, I got to air my dirty laundry.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you should, because it'd be healing for you. And stand in your beliefs. Speak your truth. Stand in your character and your values. That's vulnerability. And a lot of times, if you struggle with vulnerability on one end of the spectrum, it's probably likely that you struggle in the other area to some degree. The other piece that I'll throw in there too is like, I found it to be helpful to ask specific questions, right? So yes, I can go, hey, how are you doing? No, how are you really doing? No, how are you really doing? But I can also go, hey, how's your marriage going? How's the cash flow in your business? Specific questions is going to help bring up specific emotions, okay? And give people the opportunity to get beyond that surface level. So I found that to be really helpful as well.
What I liked there as well is you had to be pause. So often people will just go, oh, no, yeah, it's fine. And you're like, just sit quietly waiting for someone to actually answer. Yeah. And then they go, well, actually, this has been happening. Yeah. And because people don't actually know, are you really listening? You can be vulnerable, but you have to have someone that's going to hold it and be able to listen and feedback. There's some really amazing tools around that. How do you actually listen and make somebody feel safe? That is a really big thing to explore. And if you haven't done that before, there's some great tools, heartfelt listening, nonviolent communication, other tools I work with people for them to, and even just use with them, because it's such a powerful thing when you realize, oh, this is actually what I'm saying. And to hear it back, that's when the tears come. And what you've been saying is when you share your story, in many ways, that's mirroring for people. And when they hear that, it just allows something in them to go, release. It's big. So what do you do now after all this and finding that purpose? I know a lot of your work, you've written a book. There's a lot of work around sharing that purpose. Where has that led to?
Yeah. Man, empowering other peoples to share their God-given messages with the world right now. And really, it's been going on for I've always done it. Like, I taught public speaking when I was in higher education. And like, I always had coach speakers on the side to teach them the principles that I was doing to get booked and paid to speak and things like that. But probably was really like the last 3-4 years has really been solely dedicated to elevating other voices. Because I was going around, I was speaking like multiple times a week, and I was like, I'm gonna change the world. I'm gonna change the world. I'm gonna change the world. And I don't know. I just had this 2x4 hit me over the head one day that was just like, hey, if I spoke every day, 3 times a day,
you're never gonna get
it. It wouldn't change the world. No. I need to empower other people with other stories and other voices and other areas of expertise to get their messages out to the world. And so I started to do that. And that's what my life is about right now. And specifically about working people who care about the long game in that. Our company, Seeding Greatness, it comes from this quote, this Athenian quote, that communities flourish when wise elders plant seeds beneath trees they know they'll never sit under. And I think that to me, that's what my life is about. Like, I might not ever know the true ripple effect of my impact, but that's why I'm doing it. It's for the people that are going to come after me and my children's children. And so that's what my life is about right now, and helping people to do that in a way that, yes, grows their business, but also helps them to open up and to heal from their own stories.
Seeding Greatness. I love that quote, and it gave me chills. I can visualize these communities sitting under that tree, but then those elders and Yeah, I can just visualize the people that have stood behind me in my life and my ancestors. Once you see that, you also go, it's bigger than me.
Yes.
Much yes, bigger than
100%.
Me.
100%. Mm.
100%. So how do people work with you and what do you do now?
Yeah. Helping people to get their stories out there in the world, doing TEDx talks. I was just talking to a client this morning about coming out to Australia and helping them to produce some content. So we do some content days for clients. And it's really about helping them open up and express and share stories that maybe they haven't shared in a while or in a way that they haven't shared them before. Because I believe the more fully expressed we can be as leaders, my highest belief is the more open we are to the divine, but also the more impact that it makes into the world. And so that's about a lot about what my life's work is about.
Thank you so much for sharing all that you're sharing. I feel my heart is very warm from talking to you today, Daryl. I feel really joyous about having connection with people that are living their purpose. Can I ask you what bravery is to you?
Bravery is feeling all of the fear, all of the insecurity, all of the doubts, all of the what if this doesn't work, all of the what if this does work, and still doing it anyways to the best of your ability. Bravery is having blind faith. Bravery is giving everything you got, even when everything in you is saying, don't do it.
Thank you for tuning in to the Bravery Academy. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking to take your support for the podcast to the next level, visit patreon.com/thebraveryacademy to access exclusive content and get early access to our upcoming episodes. Your feedback means the world to us. So please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for being part of the Bravery Academy community. Stay brave, stay curious, and keep challenging yourself to grow. Until next time.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.